This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. Thank you so much for joining me, listeners from around the world in 164 countries. This is your host, Jason Hartman, and I am very thankful for all of you, and I am very thankful that you listen to the show, and I am very thankful that you spread the word about the show, and also very thankful for your comments and reviews about the show. So, happy Thanksgiving. We need one time a year at least to remind us to be thankful. And if you are not in the U.S. and you don't celebrate Thanksgiving, it's just a good reminder anyway. So many of us, certainly I'll just speak for myself, maybe not all of us, take all of our blessings for granted, or so many of our blessings for granted. And it is really important to remember that it is not happy people who are thankful. It is not happy people who are thankful. It is thankful people who are happy. It is thankful people who are happy. Thanks for tuning in always and for subscribing to the show and for everything else I already mentioned. So we've got a lot of amazing stuff going on. Today, our guest will be Charles Goyette, talking about what Trump means for investors and for the world. He is also one of our speakers at our upcoming Venture Alliance event in Phoenix. Phoenix and Scottsdale, Arizona, coming up in just over a week. If you'd like to join us for that, you can come as a guest. This is a Venture Alliance weekend. We've had many of them so far. You've heard me talking about them. The Venture Alliance is almost 2 years old, I guess, right? Or about a year and a half old now. And it's just been a phenomenal group. Love our Venture Alliance members. And we share some great things there. So join us as a guest. You know, check it out. See what it's all about. Go to jasonhartman.com. Click on events. Also go to VentureAllianceMastermind.com. See what the group is all about. It's for real estate investors and business people who want to take their game to the next level, live life to the fullest, and experience real abundance. Charles Goyette will be a speaker at our upcoming event. We got some other speakers too. We can't announce them because we are waiting for confirmation, but very excited about this event. So again, VentureAllianceMastermind.com and also JasonHartman.com in the events section. You really must check out the Venture Alliance. And also, while you are in the events section at JasonHartman.com, I have not announced yet, and many of you have been asking about it, and many of you have already taken action and registered in the absence of me announcing it on the podcast, but that is Meet the Masters 2017. Yes, it is confirmed. It is in Irvine, California. It is not at Hotel Irvine or Hyatt Regency Irvine, as we've had it before. We're trying another hotel this time. We needed a larger room, so we've got that coming up in January, at the usual weekend, and that is available to you at jasonhartman.com. In the events section, you can register now. Early bird pricing for Black Friday, and it ends on Friday, by the way, so you must register now because the price goes up on Saturday. It's going to go up $100 on Saturday. So register now for Meet the Masters 2017. And We have held, I think now 19 Meet the Masters. Why can't I tell you exactly? Well, it's because we used to do it twice a year, and that event requires so much coordination and so much work that we only do it once a year now. And so it's every January at the beginning of the year, and we will fly in many of our local market specialists and property management teams, flying in from around the country, and some other great speakers on some fantastic topics as it relates to asset protection, to real estate investing, to just upping your game and meeting and networking. And everybody says that they just absolutely love the networking at that event. You really get to talk to real investors who are really doing this stuff. And many of them have been investing with us for many, many years. Come out to that and join us for Meet the Masters 2017. Again, go to jasonhartman.com and register for that. And without much further ado, I've got a lot to talk to you about, but maybe you can tell in my voice, I've been a little bit sick. I was in Kansas City last week, and in this deposition I was in, oh God, what a hassle. Slow-talking, really boring attorney deposing me. And that is for the results property management case in Kansas City. As many of you know, I felt that this company was ripping me off, and I posted a video about them. They sued me over it. I posted three podcast episodes about it on one of my other shows. They sued me over that a second time. Yeah, being a consumer advocate is not an easy business, folks. You're definitely going to make some enemies. I can't talk much more about the case because, hey, I'm in litigation, and it's always quite a challenge to go through litigation. But anyway, many of you have heard that story before a long time ago. It's been going on for 6 years. Yes, 6 years now. Wow. Really, really amazing how absolutely messed up our legal system is. But hey, I'm thankful that we have a legal system. And I'm thankful that compared to many parts of the world, the American system is pretty darn good. And early next year, I will be announcing and launching, at the same time I announce it, my new startup business called FreeCourt. FreeCourt.com. You can go to the website now. There is a podcast that we are launching about FreeCourt, and it is an online dispute resolution platform because I think more people need access to provide recourse when they get ripped off or they feel they haven't gotten a fair shake. Why should they have to go spend $100,000 in this incredibly slow, ridiculous court system? Many of these judges are just, they're just wacky, or they're corrupt, even worse. You know, that happens too. You just never know what you're going to get. So I came up with an idea to solve that problem, and I'm very excited about it. I came up with this idea several years ago, finally getting around to launching it, FreeCourt.com. You'll hear more about that next year, and it could help you with your real estate investments and your life in general. So a lot more about that. Also, an interesting article. Love him or hate him, but Mr. Donald Trump, our president-elect, there has been a big spike in consumer confidence since he was elected, and I will talk more about that next week. With being a little sick, it's just been a little hard to not have a foggy head, number one, and number two, my voice, as you can tell, isn't so great. So I've got a bunch of stuff that I want to dive in with you next week, and maybe we'll just do a monologue show where I get through some of this stuff with you. So look for that. Happy Thanksgiving to all, and remember, it is not happy people who are thankful. It is thankful people who are happy. Let's get to our guest today, Charles Goyette, who is speaking at our upcoming Venture Alliance event in Phoenix, and I hope you'll join us for that, and let's talk a little bit about what President-elect Trump means to investors and to the world. Hey Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome a returning guest back to the show, and that is Mr. Charles Goyette. He is author of Red and Blue and Broke All Over, Restoring America's Free Economy, and The Dollar Meltdown, Surviving the Impending Currency Crisis with Gold, Oil, and Other Unconventional Investments. And he's got a new book coming out, and he'll probably tell you about that himself. Charles, welcome back. How are you?
Jason, it's great to speak with you again. I'm just fine.
Yeah, it's good to have you, and I am looking forward to seeing you in person because you will be speaking at our upcoming Venture Alliance Mastermind event in Phoenix. So it'll be great to have you there. Tell us what is going on with you lately. We've got a lot to talk about, a major shift in the political landscape. Wow, it's a pretty crazy time right now.
Isn't it the truth? It's like that old Chinese curse that, you know, you live in interesting times. It's certainly been interesting. Well, I've been partaking in the political discussion just about like everybody else, I guess, although from perhaps a little different perspective than the partisans of one party or another. I've been very, very happy to see the worldwide attack, the worldwide rebellion against the prevailing establishment. And by that, I mean, and it manifests in all forms. It certainly was apparent in the Brexit vote that set Europe on its heels. It was apparent in the Democratic Party with the Bernie Sanders campaign, and it's certainly apparent with the victory of Donald Trump. Now, I think this is a great thing. I think the establishment in the Western world that has done what they have done to the American middle class and to our long-term prospects for prosperity, and have plagued this country with an unending series of foreign wars. My Lord, it's been 15 years now in Afghanistan, and Iraq's going on for a dozen years. So, and an ending war with no prospect for victory in sight, and only the most radicalized elements of the Islamic world, you know, remain standing. I mean, it's just unbelievable what we have been doing at the behest of the worldwide global establishment. So I've been very happy to see the, you know, the wholesale attack on them from so many quarters. And that is actually the subject. I have a new book that I just about finished, and I just sent off to my agent. We'll see what publisher it ends up with. But it's basically, it comes from a great quote from my friend and longtime broadcast partner, Dr. Ron Paul. And he said something in one of his books, and it might have been just a little throwaway line, but I think it's one of those things that's going to end up in the Bartlett's Book of Great Quotations. He said, truth is treason in the empire of lies. And so, isn't that great? So I just picked up The Empire of Lies as the working title for this book. And it's really the subtitle, I think, makes it clear. It's the sorrowful story of the establishment's war lies, warlords, and unending foreign meddling.
Yeah, it reminds me of that George Orwell quote that said in basically in times like this, telling the truth is a revolutionary act, or something to that effect, you know, or in times of universal deception, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. I believe that's, if I didn't bastardize it too much, and that's a George Orwell quote, and that's exactly right. But you know what? Like you said, with Brexit, with oddly, liberals will never buy into this comparison, but you made it, and I think you're exactly right. With Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, similar in so many ways, oddly, because no one would usually make that comparison as you did and I do. These really are revolutions, and the establishment is falling. Thank God it's falling apart, because it needs to. This is the establishment that has put the blue-collar workers that the Democrats claim to love and support out of work with crappy trade agreements and all sorts of regulation chasing business out of town. You know, you look at Michigan as the poster child for that, obviously Ohio being the second one, but New York and California aren't far behind. You know, and Trump, he reached out to those people in an odd way and got the support of normally Democratic voters. You know, Bernie Sanders drew some good attention to a lot of problems, although I think his solutions were mostly delusional and wishful thinking. But, you know, it was interesting that he brought up a lot of the things he did. So, yeah, it's really interesting.
And I think the most amazing phenomenon about this is that this is all quite clear to you, and it's quite clear to me, and it's quite clear to so many people in flyover country. And yet in the establishment centers, and most particularly in the media centers, they are utterly perplexed. They have been blindsided by this. They have no idea. They had no idea this freight train was coming. They have no idea that people in America are disaffected and disenchanted with what's been going on. They are so wrapped up in a cocoon of ignorance, so completely out of touch with the American people and what's really been going on in the economy, what's really been going on with the destruction of the middle class and our long-term process. It was so out of touch that they are just, they are staggered. They're wobbling around as though they've been thunderstruck by something that could not have possibly happened.
You are absolutely right, especially on the side of the liberal Democrats, and they are more out of touch, I believe. In Washington, D.C., these are like these elitist people like Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton. They're just totally out of touch with America. And I believe it was Hillary many years ago who referred to that term that you just reiterated, the flyover states, you know, kind of dismissing them. Well, they came out and voted, thankfully, and they voted for change. And I'll tell you something, you know, Trump is certainly rambunctious. He's a little scary, at least I'll say that. But gosh, I'll take a gamble. And that's what America wants to do also. So I can't imagine it could be worse than the establishment we've had for the last 4 or 5 decades, which is just totally out of touch. I mean, these are just insiders. They are crony capitalists. They have been screwing the country in so many ways. And I think that's
well,
about to change.
I'm glad you're so understated about this.
Yeah. I'm usually very understated like that. Yeah, exactly. Well, so tell us what you think Trump means to the economy and to America in general. I mean, it's still hard to tell. It's obviously very early. What are your thoughts?
Well, there are a couple of things that are important to me, and they would be important to me regardless of who won. And one of the problems is institutional or systemic problem with American government and the presidency. The president now, over the course of years, has acquired such broad dictatorial powers that it is astonishing. And it is a very serious mistake for Republicans or conservatives to say these broad dictatorial powers are fine as long as our guy has them, and then thinking that they will somehow evaporate or dissipate when the other team takes place, comes up to bat, because it doesn't happen that way. And by the same token, you know, all these people that were totally happy with Obama, you know, issuing a slurry of executive orders and, ignoring the Constitution and the laws when it served his administration political purposes. All of those people now are, if they're awake and alert, they have to be wondering, well, why did we let this go on? Of course, that was the design of the American Republic from the beginning, is that none of these people were to have the kind of powers that have been allowed to accrue in the presidency. But if you think about it, the president right now can send American forces anywhere in the world to fight any time without a declaration of war. There hasn't been a declaration. Lord knows we've been fighting wars all over the world, but there hasn't been a declaration of war since December 7th, 1941. So the president is able on his own say-so to go and fight anywhere, anytime. The president on his own say-so can impose currency controls, exchange controls. They can, as you know, from and having implemented, you know, the president can order the assassination of a U.S. citizen without trial or without conviction.
Just send a little drone up and knock people off, you know, which kind of makes me wonder.
Of your communications.
Yeah, it's
I mean,
it's
all
pretty
of these
scary.
Powers have accrued to the president, and I frankly, I don't want anybody, there is nobody on the political spectrum that I trust so implicitly that I think that his successor can't do something wrong with it, with these authorities. So the idea was to, you know, to restrain the use of governmental power and so on. But man, they have accrued to a tremendously steep degree now, and they're in the hands of a very authoritarian individual beginning in January. I mean, Trump's way is authoritarianism.
Right. And it's interesting that you didn't even have to mention the use of czars, which Obama was certainly using pretty intensely. You know, these czars that have, there's no recourse, I mean, with these people that can just sort of be the environmental czar, you know? I mean, it's just crazy. So are things moving? Do you think things are going to shift back into the right direction? The interesting thing about Trump, as rambunctious as he is he says some really outlandish stuff, obviously, but you know, he doesn't owe a lot of political favors. I mean, he ran a really interesting campaign, a low-budget campaign. He's not indebted to so many people as all of these others are. You know, I think he can govern from a more sensible perspective, hopefully.
Well, that is one side of the coin. But with Trump, you get, for everything like that, you get two sides. And I'm not, you know, I'm not in any kind of vendetta against him. I actually, you know, think that the prospect of being in a nuclear exchange that can incinerate human beings all over the planet has been reduced substantially with Trump's election. And I think that's a very, very good thing. I mean, I think it seems to me abundantly clear that Hillary would have us in some sort of a nuclear showdown with Russia. It seems absolutely inevitable that she would have done this. So,
Hillary and Russia, you know, I think that if Hillary would have won, she would have had to, you know, she would feel like she had to prove herself against Putin. You know, she's a woman, so she'd have to like go overboard to show strength or something.
Well,
which
you're right.
Concerns
that
me
she,
deeply. Yeah,
she used that that whole dynamic against Obama with regard to the Libyan fiasco. I mean, this was basically hers. And you'll remember when she ran against Obama 8 years ago, she had those commercials about, you know, who do you want to get the 3 a.m. phone call? And when the phone rings in the middle of the night and it's a world crisis, who do you want? And she was basically saying, you know, I'm tough and I've been around a long time and you've got some guy that's wet behind the ears, Barack Obama, you know, has no experience, hasn't met world, yada, 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 yada. And so I think he was sensitive to that charge. And so when she and the rest of her warmongering troop decided to replicate the failure of Iraq and Libya and turn it into a jihadist hellhole, which they have done, he pretty much stood down, you know, in the face of that criticism that he had been wounded by and let her do it. So, I mean, I think that is the worst thing that was in the offing in the election was the prospect of the nuclear exchange. I think that is the worst thing. And so if that's better, I'm relatively happy that that Trump is there. Now, you mentioned the positive side of the coin, that he's not indebted to a lot of people, doesn't have a lot of chits or IOUs that he's got to pay off with political favors. The other side of that coin, though, is that he has not deeply grounded in political or economic philosophy. He's very impulsive. He's not learned with respect to monetarist economics or supply side or demand side economics or Austrian economics. He's not learned about any of those things particularly, and he disdains them. And one of my friends joked the other day, I'd be surprised if he's, you know, if he's read a complete book in the last 20 years. So the other side of this is we really don't know exactly what we're going to get from him. And I've always maintained that, you know, a good deal of politics is personality. I just, not too long ago, interviewed David Stockman, and in the course of preparing for it, I reread his book from 1984, or whatever year came about, when he was budget director for Ronald Reagan. And it's a horrifying account, Jason, of this administration that was elected and staffed. And now we're watching the cabinet be put together now for Trump. It's the same thing. All these cabinet people were brought in. They were all, you know, Reaganites, and they were interested in getting a handle on the budget deficit and shrinking government and so on and so forth. But this was Stockman's insider account, and you have never seen, despite the rhetoric of the campaign, The only Reaganite in the bunch was probably Ronald Reagan, because the hogs were feeding at the trough like you cannot believe. And I'll just give you one example. They were, you know, trying to do projections to get a, you know, a handle on anything. And the one example that comes to mind is Caspar Weinberger. And you would think that Caspar Weinberger would have been a pretty good deficit hawk. He had been the budget director himself, and he was known as Cap the Knife because he was pretty aggressive at keeping things. But when he became defense secretary, it was spend without restraint. And one of the anecdotes that I remember from Stockman's account is that they were looking at, you know, the next couple of years of preparing budgets, and they all got together and they had agreement, okay, we'll do the defense budget and the ag budget and the this budget and that budget, and we'll put in escalators for the inflation rate. So you remember after, you know, the late 70s, it looked like we were going to have double-digit inflation for a long time. I mean, so they forecast, let's just say arbitrarily, a 7% inflation rate for one of the next couple of years that they were budgeting for. But, you know, it became a moderately disinflationary period, and inflation came in at, I'm just giving you representative numbers, that they came in at 3%. So having agreed to keep real dollar defense spending the same, they had projected 7% increase to offset a 7% inflation rate. Inflation came in at 3%. The Department of Defense and Caspar Weinberger wouldn't give back the other 4%. They wouldn't relinquish the 4% growth that was built in there on the assumption that inflation rate was going to be a lot higher. So you had, you know, the massive Reagan deficits and so on and so forth, and you had a sudden and steep rise in concentration of wealth and wealth inequality in America as a consequence of that period. So, I mean, that's Stockman's view of it. Personality matters, and when you watch the personality, all these Reaganites that came in there weren't really Reaganites as much as they talked about it. And when push came to shove, they were willing to demand a lot more for their departments, their special favors, their special interests. And if the budget was going to be balanced, it was going to be at somebody else's expense. So I'm
that's the way it always goes. You know, that's the way it always goes.
It's perpetual, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just disgusting. The problem is there's like a structural problem with government. And I'd say, and you know, you may disagree with me on any of this, but I'd say one of the big structural problems is the way lobbying works and the lack of term limits. The founding fathers never intended to have career politicians. We all know that, but that's what we got, you know.
that's sure what we've got. So this makes the staffing of the Trump administration in particular interest, because the personalities that come in are going to be interesting. And so far, the people that, the, you know, we don't have a Treasury secretary, and we don't have some of those people. There'll be a couple of Fed appointments right away. So we don't see a lot of the economic side of it, but we do see the national security state and the growth of the national security state. And it looks like Trump is the only one, like Reagan was the only Reaganite. It looks like Trump, in that whole triumvirate of, and the prospects of people for Secretary of State and NSA and so on and so forth, it looks like Trump is the only one that wants to stand down the confrontation with Russia. So it's a very interesting, you know, everything's in motion. We're in uncharted territory, and we haven't even talked about the economic outlook. We're still kind of talking about the, you know, the national security issue and where we would have been for certain with Hillary and where we still may be in a Trump administration.
One thing, yeah, let's get on to economics, because that's where everybody's mind is, really. But one thing I do want to ask you, Charles, is Hillary, it's interesting, everything we just talked about, if a Hillary supporter were listening to this talk right now, they would say, but wait, that's the opposite. Hillary criticized Trump, saying things like, do you want him on the nuclear button when he can't even handle his Twitter account? You know, she would give him a hard time about the way he lashed out about things. But really, Hillary was the warmonger of the two, I'd say.
She never met a war she didn't like. And I mean, she has a long track record of it, back to her husband's administration. And, you know, and she was quick when the worm turned, when the people woke up to what a folly that Iraq had been. You know, she was quick to turn and disavow her support for it. But I remember watching her disgusting, arrogant dismissal of people that were trying to warn her in advance of her vote about the Iraq war. But in any event, you know, she owns Libya. It's a disaster that didn't need to happen, and she did it. I think we can be pretty sure from WikiLeaks releases and some other stuff. Well, we can be sure because we know her political ambitions. It seems to me it's quite apparent that she did it to burnish her foreign affairs resume for her contemplated run for the presidency. And, of course, all it did is say that she hadn't learned anything in Iraq, could she? And then they've delivered us this debacle in Syria, which is not only – I mean, this is so insane, Jason. You have jihadists in Syria who are fighting – who are armed by the CIA, who are fighting jihadists in Syria who are armed by the Pentagon. This is your tax dollars at work. These people are insane.
We're creating wars all over the place. And, you know, maybe the way to deal with that is the Ron Paul method, which is just the more isolationist concept. But, you know, we could talk about foreign stuff forever, okay? What about the economy? Let's talk about that. I mean, you know, I think Trump is kind of inflationary, and I don't think that's a bad thing because as a real estate investor, I like inflation. You know, it's the home run for real estate investors, especially with debt that can basically be paid off by inflation. And of course, rents and property values are indexed to inflation to some extent. But, you know, I mean, you know, if he has a more protectionist policy, which he says is what he wants, it's going to bring jobs back to America. Wages will rise, but also along with that, prices will rise too, with the exception of something that is ingrained in everything, and that's energy. I think energy will get a lot cheaper under Trump because he's going to explore it and let us become an exporter, and we're just going to produce a lot more energy here, which I think is a great thing, by the way. But, you know, what are your thoughts?
Well, there are three items that I think we want to keep our eye on with respect to Trump, and this too is uncharted because, you know, we know in America what Keynesian economics is, and roughly Keynesian economics could be called — it's never called this, but it could be called demand-side economics. But Keynesian economics is that, you know, when the economy is slow, when the economy is in the doldrums, the government will spend money that it doesn't have to create demand, hence demand-side, but create demand. So the government, you know, will, you know, buy shovels for everybody and let them lean on them on government jobs and so on. And, you know, to create unemployment as a way, they say, of sort of priming the pump. By the way, the flip side of that Keynesian idea was that that's what the government was supposed to do in bad times, is spend money that it didn't have to stimulate the economy. And then in good times, it was supposed to run the surplus to make up for the deficits. Of course, they haven't done that. They run deficits in good times and bad times.
Keynesianism always distorts markets. It's always a disaster. Always. It just never works.
Always.
And it always — the handouts go to political cronies like Solyndra. So, you know, that it doesn't work. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But go ahead.
But this time we're going to have the very bizarre splicing together of this Keynesian demand side economics and supply side economics. Now, this has never really been done in a full-tilt boogie sort of a way that that it will be done right now. But you have, for example, on the Keynesian side, you have Steve Bannon, the chief strategist guy, and he's in there. The reason he's in there is because he has resonated with Trump on a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. $1 trillion. So this is a massive Keynesian project. This is a Keynesian project of, and that's only part of it. Then there's the wall, to the extent that gets takes money, and then there's more defense spending that Trump has promised. So you have massive demand side or Keynesian spending going on. At the same time, the administration at least has promised a supply side stimulus of corporate tax cuts and other tax cuts, and so you have. You have a period coming up in which I would say the worst of both worlds are going to be joined together in some sort of a weird Frankenstein Frankenstein's creation. And then the third thing that I think we want to watch is the trade war. And this seems to be a very serious thing, but I'd like to remind your listeners that even in the 1930s, even before the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, the Smoot-Hawley Tariff taxed 20,000 goods imported into the United States, built huge tariffs into the importation of 20,000 goods under the same sort of a trade war promise of higher employment domestically and so forth that we got here. But even before it was signed into law by Hoover in June of 1930, already trade started to collapse, to cast a long shadow in advance. And like Jude Winiski's track the legislation, he says clear it was responsible for the stock market crash in October of 29. But here's I'll just give you an anecdote of the kinds of things that go on when you start slapping tariffs on other countries, and you know, instead of freeing markets, you start closing markets and so on. At the time, then all of a sudden you see foreign nations start creating their retaliatory tariffs. And they create those in advance of, when they see you're talking about, slapping down their imports, and they start talking about slapping down our imports. And just to give you one anecdote, olive oil. In the 1930s, olive oil production in the United States was nothing. It mattered. I mean, it's so little. It's not a major part of our economy. But, there were olive oil producers in the United States, very small, but they got their congressman's ear. And so in the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, they slapped high tariffs to protect, some small, almost insignificant cronies that had contributed to one or two congressmen and one or two districts. So they slapped these huge high tariffs on olive oil coming into the United States to force the American consumer, instead of buying what they really wanted was extra virgin olive oil direct from Italy. They wanted to make them buy inferior grade American olive oil, to line the pockets of the constituents. So the politicians write these high tariffs in on olive oil. So what happened in Italy, which was so dependent on the olive oil industry? It was small here, it was big to them. So all of a sudden, people that were driving American cars in the early 1930s in Italy started, they find their tires had been flattened or their windshields had been broken. And today, you'd say their cars got keyed, which is what happens when you have a bumper sticker of somebody doesn't like on your car at the parking lot these days.
Well, that's because you have these very tolerant liberals.
I don't know
what's interesting about that? I just got to make a comment here, and this is a little off topic, obviously, but you see all these protests and after the post-election, and people have the right to protest, and I want that. I protect and support their right to protest, but they're violent and they destroy property, and that's just completely uncalled for. Yet, everybody, the last time around, the first time Obama ran, the second time, everybody was criticizing the Tea Party and how these are so evil, these rotten Americans, and, these veterans that are, Nancy Pelosi said these veterans could be dangerous. They shouldn't get firearms license. I mean, that's just absurd, completely absurd. And yet I didn't see any Tea Party protests after Obama's election twice. Okay, but it's.
You didn't see the media sympathizing with them and handing them Kleenexes to dry their poor red eyes from all
and giving them safety pins. They got to give them safety pins .
But I want to come back to the tariff thing, because it wasn't just that American car drivers found their tires had been flat in the air, been let out, and so on and so forth, but Italy retired. Now, this was being replicated all over the world by manufacturers of other products, but in just this one anecdote that I've chosen, just because I think it's so vivid, because it was so unimportant to our economy for them to have done this in the first place. So all of a sudden, in retaliation, Italy imposed steep tariffs on American cars. So all the American car dealerships in Italy closed, and that increased unemployment in Italy. So what did that do? Now, this was being replicated around the world. So what did that do to employment of automobile manufacturers in the United States? It reduced employment of automobile manufacturers here because they were losing their export markets in retaliation for, in the case that I've chosen, just olive oil, just something insignificant. But they had promised us, that with these with these trade restrictions, with this tariff war and so on, that we were going to reduce unemployment and so on. You know, a year after the stock market crashed in 29, a year later, the unemployment rate in the United States wasn't even double digits. But by the time they got done shutting down trade with Smoot-Hawley tariffs and stuff, we were 25%.
That
is serious.
Okay, so let me ask you a question here, Charles. Look, you're a free market guy, you're a libertarian, you're a Ron Paul guy, so am I. And conceptually, I certainly agree with you about the concept of free trade. But here's the problem. You know, when you don't have a level playing field, and you have these companies that go set up shop just south of the border, and they don't have the same regulations that you do just slightly north of the border, right? Or, you know, the same with China. They don't have the shops over there don't have the environmental restrictions. They don't have OSHA. They don't have minimum wage like we do, you know, or at least not to the extent that we do, and healthcare mandates and all this crap. You can't have free trade when the playing field is so unlevel. Can you? I don't think you can, because it's not a level playing field. If it was somewhere close to level, I would say, yeah, just open it up and let it roll, man. Free trade. But it does seem like there is a case for some sort of tariff, for charging companies admission to our huge consumer market. I don't know. It's a very complicated issue.
Well, it is complicated. The two things I'll say just in passing. One is that all of the currencies of the world are irredeemable, and the benchmarks against which they trade are meaningless. They are made up. And so when somebody's currency is high, somebody's currency is low, these are problems that are eliminated in the use of a real global currency that people all over the world for thousands of years have relied upon. So all these artificial currencies that have no backing, they're fiat currencies, they are issued by, used to be the printing press, and today it's just, you know, you whirl some electrons off in cyberspace and you create a bunch more of them. You know, this is a game, and it's a fraud that's underway. And so on the one hand, the issue of fair trade and free trade always comes down to, you know, who's manipulating their currency and who is hurt from it and who is benefited from it. All these problems go away in the face of non-manipulated, non-fabricated fiat government monetary system. But I think the other part of the argument is that when it comes to production and to outproducing your neighbor and outcompeting your neighbor, there's one element that trumps, if you forgive the word, every other one, and that is capital. Capital creates wealth. And so if people in the third world stitch shoes and they can make, you know, one pair of shoes or two pair of shoes a day, and in the first world the shoes are made with machines and robotics and, you know, and one operator can make, you know, 150 pairs of shoes a day,
it levels the playing field.
So the problem in America that has gone under the radar, in my view, I mean, it was inevitable that you know, as foreign countries, as they threw off the yoke of communism and they began to wake up and they wanted to have, you know, good dentistry and homes and refrigerators and stuff, and they got rid of the commies, you know, that they would start demanding, you know, an opportunity to produce things, and they would have to do so at a lower wage rate than in America. But the real problem is that they have made their country safe for capital to buy the equipment, to do the manufacturing and so on, that has enabled them to compete. And that's fine, because we could be a haven for capital too, but America has been at war with its capital now for a couple of generations, and it's getting pretty severe. So if we fix that, if, you know, you don't even need to worry about the level playing field, because our capital makes us far more productive than manufacturing plants in, you know, in Vietnam that now are stealing jobs from the Chinese because they're willing to work for less money. But our capital can make us so much more productive, and always has been able to make us more productive. But as capital is made unsafe through taxation and currency depreciation and Federal Reserve policies and so on, it starts going elsewhere looking for safer safer havens and safer opportunities. So,
So Charles, what is your prediction about that under a Trump administration? I think that's going to get better. I think Trump understands that. And he understands, I mean, you know what I think is going to be the best thing about him? I mean, love him or hate him, but if nothing else, he knows how to get stuff done. He has existed all his life in the real economy, not this BS government economy, this closed crony system that the government has running. You know, he lives in the world, or has lived in the world, where you have to produce results just like all the rest of us in the normal world of commerce and markets. You know, I think that's going to be great about him.
Well, I sure hold out to hope that you're right, because we are in a system now of so deeply immersed in crony capitalism, which is basically that, you know, the profits are privatized and the losses are socialized. And, you know, we're run by cartels, the banking cartel, the agribusiness consortium, sports oligarchs. Here in the town where I live, you know, the hockey team wants, you know, $200 million from the taxpayers, and the baseball team wants a new stadium for a couple hundred million dollars. Wait, didn't they get one for $500 million not too many years ago? And the football team, it goes on and on and on and on.
It never ends.
And
yeah.
The problem is, when they run into expenses or they need money, you pay for it. But when the team is a hit and they sell a lot of shirts and they make a Super Bowl or what, they never send you a dividend check. It's funny how that works. So I know he understands that, and I feel in many ways he's not as beholden to the cronies, and Lord knows they're breaking the back of the productivity of America. I mean, congressmen go to Washington and they spend their time currying favor with cronies, and then they retire and you know, enter jobs that are set for life. The guy that ran you know, the Bush prescription drug bill through Congress, you know, left Congress just before the ink dried on it, and he took a $2 million a year being the head of a lobbying association for it. You know?
How convenient. How convenient.
Well, it's like Hillary Clinton getting $375,000 for a speech. Are you telling me, is it because of her rhetorical skills? I don't think so. You know, so, I mean, it's just, if the system is rotten and it stinks, and Trump has said that he will drain the swamp, well, I sure hope he does. And I think, again, we come back around to, you know, politics is personality, and if he's got an administration of people that really are committed to draining the swamp and not lobbyists and not looking to take care of their friends. You know, he blew Chris Christie out the other day for basically that sin of, you know, staffing the transition team with a bunch of lobbyists and people interested in lining their own pockets, or at least so it had the appearance of that. Certainly it was thick with lobbyists, and it had the appearance of being guys that were interested in getting what they could. So, you know, that was a helpful sign. So I think we're in a really interesting period now, and we can read the future. And actually is why I'm looking forward to speaking to your group, because, you know, when we get together in a week or two, there will be a lot more water under the bridge, so to speak, and we'll have a much better idea of how this is shaping up and who the personalities are and what the ox is that they each want to gore.
It's going to be fascinating. Yeah,
it is.
You know, when the election swung and you know, Hillary conceded, I posted on my Facebook that this is going to be the most interesting presidency ever. I have 4 years of podcast content.
Oh, you do.
Already.
Oh,
it's in
God.
The bag.
It's a great time to be doing a podcast, for sure.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Coming at you thick and fast, and there we are with the $20 trillion in debt, and over the last year they've been increasing the debt by, I don't know, it's about $3.8 billion, I think, a day now. $3.8 billion a day. It's just criminal.
It's time to make
a
change.
Yeah, we're in a really interesting time.
Very interesting. Charles, give out your website. Tell people where they can find your books and more about you.
Well, there's not a lot to tell. CharlesGoyette.com. I have two books out right now. I'm actually thinking about reissuing The Dollar Meltdown. I wrote that in 2008, and I said, you know, the prognostications, the predictions in here are good for the next couple of years and maybe even 3 years out. And bada bing, bada boom, it worked out perfectly because, you know, I said, but But I've written this book to show you kind of the precedents of the economic and the monetary theory and so on that drove the predictions that I'm making, so that in the future, as conditions change, you know, you'll be able to implement those same sorts of ideas in a new way, but you'll understand the basic principles. And so, but I said, in the intro to the investment section, I said, so these recommendations, you can't write a book in, say, 2016 that makes economic recommendations for the year 2026, you know what I mean? Too much stuff happens, but you can write one for what's going on the next few years. So I did that. But now we're starting to cycle back into the same kind of period. I'm actually thinking of bringing that back out with some revisions. But anyway, it's The Dollar Meltdown. That's still available, a New York Times bestseller. And then in the midst of that, I was asked to write a book about how we can restore America's prosperity. So the first book was, what do you do to protect yourself when things get crazy like this? And that's what The Dollar Meltdown was all about. And then I wrote one for people that are interested in restoring the vitality, the robustness of America, and to restore the American dream. And I actually said in there, Jason, quite frankly, I don't think that people will do this. I don't think they'll make their politicians do this. We have become so spoiled. Everybody wants to live at the expense of everybody else in this country today. I don't think that people are interested in restoring America's prosperity. But and I wrote Red and Blue and Broke All Over, and the title is Red and Blue and Broke All Over, because it's the Red Party and the Blue Party working together that have done this to us. So I wrote Red and Blue and Broke All Over about the complicity of the two parties in Washington, the Washington bird of prey with two wings, that, fleecing us and depriving us of the American dream and so on, and how to restore America's free economy is the subtitle. So those are both available. And then I have a new book presumably come out sometime in the new year. I'm just sent it off, as I said, to my agent this last week, and we'll see who decides to publish it, if indeed anybody. But it's called The Empire of Lies.
Fantastic. And did you give out your website, Charles?
Yeah, charlesgoyette.com. And I just don't put a lot of information on there, but for people that need to find the books or, you know, to get a hold of me and so on, that's a way to do it.
Fantastic. And just let me spell Goyette is G-O-Y-E-T-T-E, Charles Goyette. And Charles, thank you so much for joining us again today. It was great to talk to you, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks, Jason. Always great to speak with you.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.